speed up or that the union, that the union sort of sold out during the war.
No, no. The union organizers were very strict in their enforcement of the contract. The problem of equal pay for equal work didn't apply necessarily to this industry. It was the service industry in which there were all women in certain departments and all men in certain other departments. And the question of equal pay was not applicable here.
Did any of the men go overseas and a lot of women?
There were a great many people, a great many workers who were drafted into the service. And one of my important tasks was to educate the workers about the war and about what fascism meant and the nature of fascism. And we had many meetings in the hotels during the war. As a matter of fact, even the management would cooperate with us in getting the workers together at a certain hour when the hotels were not too busy, so the mid afternoon, and we would have whole departments come and hear reports about the war, ask them to support war relief and buy war bonds and in general educate them about the politics of the war.
Was there any daycare for women workers there?
No.
Any attempt to make it easier for women workers?
No. No. The question of daycare never arose in the union at all. Never. There were many women, I'm sure, who had small children who worked in the housekeeping department or worked as waitresses.
But the question did not arise.
Well, during the war, when I came to the hotel industry as an educational director, there were hardly any black women.
Mm-hmm.
But because the policy of the union was to encourage black employment of blacks, we soon began to see in our employment office people coming in to apply for jobs. And we worked out a policy by which we would introduce into some of the most aristocratic hotels, like the St. Regis and the Plaza and so on, we worked out a policy by which we would introduce black workers in the housekeeping department, because there was great resentment and fear on the part of the hotel customers to having people, black workers in their rooms, cleaning their rooms. They feared death, they feared other things, and we had to do something to convince management that our union workers would be responsible.
As educational director,
we discussed this, you see, and we would often when a black person came to the employment department. There were several places where they first were introduced. They were first introduced among the waiters, and there was a great deal of dissatisfaction among the white waiters that the blacks were taking their place and so forth. But nevertheless, we pushed this, and we soon had some black waiters in some hotels, but not in the best hotels. In the best hotels, they were still getting white waiters, and white in the bar department. When I left the union, there were still no black.
And that was a better paid bar.
That was highly paid. That was the most.
So it was integration on
the
lowest
skilled
level.
Department right. in the hotel industry, and therefore the
did the Communist Party encourage integration? Because I know there are a lot of articles about how they really sold out on the blacks.
Well, as far as the party was concerned in the union,
yeah.
We worked very hard to bring black people into the union. And little by little, we were able to get black workers, women workers, into the housekeeping department.
Mm-hmm.
And we started out by taking very light-colored ones first,
mm-hmm.
because we thought that they would be integrated more easily. And then as time went on, and particularly as the war went on, there were fewer and fewer workers available because so many were involved in war work. The management broke down, and finally there were many, many departments. When I left, there were many housekeeping departments that had been all white when I came there, and they weren't all black when I left.
Oh. And did they get laid off during the war, do you know? After the war, did they get laid off? Black workers?
I wasn't there after the war, but I still think that the black workers still dominate the hotels.
Did you talk about what would happen during the war to the people?
Well, of course. We had some excellent discussions all the time in the unions and in the hotels.
Like what?
In the shops.
What kinds of things?
Well, discussions about the war and the significance of the war and the attitude of the various governments and so on. Of course, we had to be careful because we couldn't be anti-government in that period, you know. So, but we, for example, when the Second Front failed to appear, we spent lots of time explaining to the workers that this was wrong, that they were letting Russia bleed, and that after all, the American armies and the British armies should be fighting Hitler too.
Not a phony war.
Yeah, all that sort of thing. We brought that all out. And you see, we had among our organizers, most of them were party members, you see.
Right.
And the whole official staff was party
members. Now, did the party tell you did the party give you advice on organizing?
No, but you see, we were the party.
Yeah, I know,
but we didn't go...
But who educated you?
Well, you were the party. Well, now, the top officials probably had contacts with the center of the party and talked over their problems. And they, of course, were closer to the politics of the trade unionism than we were, you see. That we were actually the functionaries,
right.
The people who carried out the orders, so to speak. But within the union itself, the organizers who went to the hotels and organized them and who talked to the workers and who were the ones who saw to it that the contract was enforced so that the workers would have their full rights, these were mostly communists, and they did a very, very good job.
But no one gave you advice. You said you shouldn't talk about this, you shouldn't talk about that.
No, we never told that. But we used to have board meetings in which we would discuss certain problems in regard to the employers, to the workers. There were some very, very frank discussions.
Like what kind of issues? Remember? See, because they did take a no-strike pledge. You didn't mind that?
We didn't have a no-strike pledge. There was no no-strike pledge in our contracts. Our contracts were straight contracts because we were not in a war industry.
So it really didn't apply. Was there a lot of overtime?
There was, but they had to pay for overtime. And so the employer...
Time and a half?
Yes, that's right. We had a very good contract. Our workers really... The standards in the hotel industry...
So it wasn't like the mining industry or the steel industry?
No, it was quite different. It was a service industry, you see.
I guess that's really different.
Yeah, and you can't apply that to them. But there were, for example... I'm trying to think of some of the problems that arose
that you discussed, and what would happen if there were differences.
Oh, there were vast differences,
and we had
two black organizers who were communists who had constant differences with the white organizers.
What were their differences?
Well, the possibility of promotion from one type of job to another. And the fact that sometimes the blacks were kept down and the whites were preferred. There was always this problem of promotion because usually the blacks had the most, the drudgery and the hard work was done by, and then the more lucrative aspects like being a bellman or being a waiter, these were always confined to the whites. And we were always discussing how we can change this situation, how we can bring about a different kind of approach to it so that anyone who qualifies will be promoted and not just white people alone.
Right.
And these were arguments about how to approach the employers because the employers were just as resistant as the workers were.
Right.
And the workers really took their cue from the employers rather than from us. They were not a very intelligent group of workers when we organized them. I mean, intelligent from the standpoint of trade union consciousness. We had to work very hard to get them to understand what it meant to do what the union told them to do. Very often they would work with the employers against the union. These were problems for newly organized workers.
Was there conflict between different ethnic groups too? What was the conflict? It was black. You said there were black workers.
Right. Yeah. There were many ethnic groups. Many, and there were many hotels where they had just one type
you see. Uh-huh.
Like what, Italians? Or
well, yes. For instance, there would be a banquet department would be just Italian workers, and we broke that down. The union broke down.
No.
We tried to integrate the various groups in the union so that everybody would have a chance. It was a very class conscious, wonderful leadership in that union.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the after the war situation changed considerably. During the war, there was great harmony and unity, even though we had differences, and there were rivalries, and there were all kinds of other differences within.
What, you don't remember what the differences were? I guess it's hard to
I can't remember that anymore.
The thing is that you did the welfare work too, and weren't a lot of families overcrowded in housing?
Yeah. So then we got a welfare director who was my second part of the job. Yeah, and who did all the personal things, because
uh-huh.
I was more interested in the broader educational problems, getting out materials and so
on.
And
did you give classes all during
yes,
the time?
Yes, we gave classes. We had classes after work and even during working hours, because the shifts were so different within the hotels. It was possible to have a class at 11 o'clock in the morning for some of them, you see.
Right.
And sometimes at 2 in the afternoon.
And they came to the classes.
They came to the classes and they listened. And we used to make a big function out of inducting workers into the union. We would make it quite a ceremony,
like a marriage.
And that, yes, and that involved education, you see. They would come in, they would be told that they would be given their books after they had attended a series of, say, 6 lectures on trade unionism,
uh-huh.
you see. And we used gimmicks of this sort to encourage the workers to study. And,
uh-huh.
and then we sold books, and we tried to get people to read books,
uh-huh.
and we used to have...
What books did you get people to read?
Well, at that time, Huberman had a very good book out. It was one of his early books. The Labor Spies, I think.
And he had another book. No.
Yeah, and then he had another book on organization.
Yeah.
And, there were a number of things. And then we used to have exhibits, art exhibits, especially during the war. We would have art posters and
did you play up the fight that the Soviets were making, particularly?
Yes, you see, that was our role. We,
uh-huh.
we tried to get them to understand the role of the Soviet Union and to understand what the Soviet Union stood for and so on. And that type of propaganda we did very well. But truthfully, we couldn't go too far because the workers in the housekeeping department were primarily Irish. And the Catholic influence was strong. In the bar department, it was similar. Among the waiters, they were mixed. There were Italians and French and German, all kinds, all classes. And the waiters were, as a group, a much more highly intelligent group more highly developed
mm-hmm.
than the bartenders, because they were most of them frustrated professionals of one sort or another. So in that group we had a different situation. There were many very very fine workers among them, and then of course we had all the workers who did the drudgery, the porters, the maintenance men, the hard work, the kitchen help. These were mostly recruited from the Spanish Puerto Rican workers.
Puerto Rican even at that time?
Oh yes, we used to have a real problem with the Puerto Rican workers because they were very undisciplined. You know, they came from an agricultural rural area, and they didn't know what it was to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and go to work and come home at a certain hour. So they would very often come in at 10, or they're supposed to be in at 8:30, come in at 10, or they'd leave the job at 2 o'clock, you know, and then of course they were fired. So there were constant problems there. And finally, we put on a Spanish organizer who used to talk to them in their own language. It was very hard to educate them because they really, they didn't even know the fundamentals of English, you see. And we had many problems with them. And there were many arguments about how to handle these problems.
Uh-huh.
You were
working on your book all the time, too?
Well, now, in 1940, before I became the educational director of the hotel
union, uh-huh.
I had a respite period of about a year in which we were having a very hard time financially, but I couldn't get a job. The UOPWA job was over, and I had to have a job with pay, so I didn't want to undertake any volunteer projects, and things were very tough for us. we just didn't have enough income, that's all. And so during that period, I had time, and that was when I worked on the service book, and it was published in 1941. It was Trachtenberg's idea that we do a series on labor leaders, and he said, why don't we start first with the first labor leader?
Right.
So I started researching, and then I started working on it, and he was quite pleased and surprised that I had responded that way, you see, because I brought him a manuscript one day. And he was very pleased with that. And so they went over that. And
did you plan to continue to do more labor leaders?
Yes,
why
I wanted
did you
to.
Stop
but,
it?
Well, I my job was so all-absorbing, you see.
Oh, the food.
Yes.
And you
see,
never had
this
time.
This is, again, the conflict between writing and being an activist.
Who else were you going to do?
What?
Who else were you thinking of doing?
Well, there were a whole series. There was a woman in the Knights of Labor that I wanted to do. And
yes, what is that woman?
I've forgotten her name now. I don't.
In our book.
I don't remember. There were a number of others that were in the
Leonora Barron.
That's it, Leonora Barron. Right.
So you wanted to do something on her?
I wanted to do something on her. As a matter of fact, I had some material that I had gathered. I wanted to go on with women, you see. And I was very interested in what were those two women? Octavia, so on, you know, those nutty women, who one of whom ran for president.
Oh, the Woodhulls.
I wanted to do some of the Woodhulls, and then
Franklin and Woodhull,
yeah,
who translated the Engels.
Yes, and
so you were interested in her,
yes,
too.
Yes. Well, you see, it was possible in the 30s and 40s to get the Claflin Weekly, but now it's so difficult to get those old journals. They're some of them have been stolen, some of them have been. Are you able to get them?
Only at the library.
Yeah,
I looked through them all.
Yeah, but in those
days. So you were interested. Who else were you interested in?
Oh, I was interested in Susan Anthony not Rose Pastor Stewart. In the 19th century people.
Susan B. Anthony and the Working Women's Protective Association, the Working Women's Suffrage League. You were interested
in.
So you really did a lot of work in women's history.
Oh, I did. Yes, because you see, I was giving lectures all the time, and I wanted to replenish my materials all the time and introduce women's problems. I always spoke about women's problems.
What other, do you remember what other women?
And Carrie Chapman Catt.
How about Mary Kenny O'Sullivan? She was an organizer for the AFL.
I didn't know her at all.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, as time went on, I was still interested in women when I started with Rosa Luxemburg. And I always wanted to do something on Kate Richards O'Hare, but I never got to.
So when you started on the food workers, it was so busy that you could never continue that series.
Oh, it was impossible, because we had evening meetings, we had board meetings, we had hotel meetings. It was a constant.
And it was a 24-hour day job.
Absolutely. At that time, Mira once said she thought I was only a weekend mother.
And you did have weekends off.
I had weekends off. Yes.
And Bernard didn't mind this at all.
And he was terribly absorbed in his own work, and he was glad that I was busy, and we did have extra income, you see, when I started with the food workers. I was getting the organizer's salary, you see, which was very high at that time. So it changed our whole picture. And then things began to improve for Bernard, too. As soon as the Soviet Union became a participant, we became a participant with the Soviet Union as an ally, the whole picture in the universities changed.
Uh-huh.
You see, and he was able to get lectureships. For instance, one year he lectured for a whole term at Yale while he was teaching at Columbia. You see, and then he got summer work. We were one summer at Penn State, and another summer at University of Denver, and a third summer.
And what did you do when you went to the University of Pennsylsania and University of Denver?
Did you take off from your work?
Yes,
I would get a month's vacation. Everybody got a month's vacation. You know, the union standards were very high for the officials, too. So I'd have a regular month's vacation, then I'd take 2 weeks in addition.
Uh-huh.
They didn't mind that. So I'd have 6 weeks. So all during the 40s, we had a much better situation, and our financial situation improved tremendously. And it was quite a rewarding period, because
and you had that job for how long?
Well, I came there in 1941, and I was fired in 1950 because of the jail business, you know.
So that you really had it all, even after the war, so during the war?
During the war, right straight through to 1950.
Mm-hmm. And you edited the newspaper?
No, I was not the editor of the paper then. I was only the educational director, but the editor and I worked very closely together on various topics that we wanted to present, you see, educational topics and things we wanted to stress in the educational field. And I tried to develop a good educational program. It was difficult because the war was on everybody's mind, and it was hard to separate out some of the other objectives that you would have in an educational program from the war itself, you know?
Right. But then the war ended in 45, what happened?
Well, then it was the beginning of my problems with the House Un-American Activities Committee.
I think we should do a whole tape on that.
That has to be done separately.
When the war ended, did the food workers have any program for all the people that were going to be laid off because of the war? You know, the people that had gone to war, did they come back for their jobs?
Some sort of a rule that the man who had to leave his job because of the war would get it back again when he returned.
So what happened to the people who bumped?
And then we had a problem with that. Mm. And we tried very hard to fit them into part-time jobs and things of that nature. But they understood when they took the jobs that they were filling in for a serviceman, you see. Mm-hmm. And it was a matter of great pride that we were able to give them back their jobs, because when they came back from the war, obviously many of them had served.
Didn't the people object that were being laid off?
Well, of course there was objection, but you see, in the hotel industry, it was quite different from other industries. It's very much of a transient industry. People come and people go. And there were many, many people who would give up work like that in the hotels, even though they were well paid and had a good income, because they were just that type. They were not rooted people, you see.
Right. Now, then after the war, you know, there was that big strike wave because of inflation.
Yes.
Did that affect the food workers? Do you know what I mean? After the war, there was an enormous strike wave.
But that didn't happen until the 50s.
46, 47, that was the big strike.
We didn't have it. We had contracts that covered the workers. But there were evidences of retreat on the part of our top officials. And this is what brought about a great many of the arguments in the party itself, you see, on the questions of retreat, how far do you retreat, and so on.
What kind of retreat?
Well, for example, I remember that in the late 40s, when we had to, I think we had 2 or 3 year contracts, and when the contract ran out and you had to negotiate a new contract, they used gimmicks, you see. For example, they would say, well, we'll give you fringe benefits, but we won't give you cash wage benefits, you see. So the fringe benefit became the ultimate goal, you see. And, of course, there was great criticism of that, because while the fringe benefits were important, they got an extra week in vacations, or they got... toward the end of my stay there, they actually got a whole health program.
Now, when you talk about this retreat, did the communists agree with this retreat?
No, you see, these were arguments that I wasn't in on, because they were policy problems, and they had to do with the top echelons of the party and the people that were the leaders.
But they affected you.
But they affected us in the sense that they were always being brought up at executive board meetings and even at party meetings of the groups, you know, the people within the party and the union. And the question was, for example, I remember one of the biggest issues was the question of whether we should ask for cash wage increases and fringe benefits or fringe benefits, you see. And this was a terrific battle. And the organizers, many of them, were up in arms against the leadership. Mm-hmm. See, this is the beginning of the break, because the leadership was listening to the AFL-CIO.
That's what I was...
I remember that one year they didn't get any cash increases, and the inflation was there.
Because you had to deal with the workers.
That's right. So, but what they did get was an extra week's vacation, or some steps towards a health plan.
Now, see, I want to say something about the health plan,
because the hotel union was the first union that introduced the idea of a health plan with health clinics, with doctors to examine the workers and to provide medical care. To provide medical care for our union members.
Uh-huh.
We were one of the
and
first.
And paid for it.
Union.
Uh-huh.
See,
oh,
but that
not
was
the management.
That's right. You see, it was not a. Oh, the management. The management shared in this.
Oh, okay.
That was part of their contribution, you see, in lieu of wages, you see. And this was what caused such tremendous uproar within the among the organizers, that they couldn't face the workers and say, no, there won't be any wage increases this time, but there will be some small fringe benefits, didn't amount to a hill of beans, you know. Mm. So there was a terrific amount of discussion on that, and a lot of
Now, what I was going to say is, you as an organizer, if you didn't like the policy of, say, if you objected to this idea that they weren't getting cash benefits, how could you make that known?
Well, we had board meetings, you see, our own executive board in the union, and of course we also had party meetings. We could make our feelings felt in the party, and we could make our feelings felt in the board. And, see, I was not an organizer. I was what you might call a paid professional employee, you see.
Right.
And so I could speak, and I did speak. But the people who carried the ball were the organizers who were also party members, who would go to the party and fight there, and then they would come back to the board and fight there.
Mm-hmm.
And this created, we used to have meetings until 2 and 3 in the morning. This was a very active union,
uh-huh.
and a very all of our organizers and all of our staff were very trade union conscious and very class conscious
and
aware of what the problems were.
Whose side were you on, or what were your opinions about what was going on?
Well, I don't know how I can express that, because all of the officers were communists, you see.
Uh-huh.
So you couldn't be on the side. You could simply take a position on an issue,
uh-huh.
you see.
But like on cash benefits.
Oh, well, I was for cash wages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew what the workers needed, and they all knew it. But the negotiations and the employers were going bad. They were having very great difficulties, so they retreated, you see.
Why didn't they push ahead further?
Because they were not that kind. They were not the UE organizers, you understand?
Uh-huh.
They were pragmatic. They did what they could get.
But they got what they could get.
Sure they were, sure. And later when I get into the whole discussion of what happened to the union, you will see that it was a logical development from that point on, that these people would verge towards an AFL position rather than a party position.
Okay, I guess that should be it.
Yeah.